a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on the apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. The screen door slammed, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. I said, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Ooh, ba, 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 ba. The paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Ooh, ba, 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 ba. The paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. Tonight we'll be doing a replay of an interview we did a few months ago with Rod Fujita and Naya Van Leeuwen. They've written an amazing book called Making Shift Happen that's all about strategies for behavioral change. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Neil Yelland. He's a financial advisor with Edward Jones in Chico. No matter where you are in life's journey, Neil can offer guidance and strategies for wealth and retirement income, and for college savings accounts, estate and legacy plans, charitable giving, and more. For a consultation or more information, Neil can be reached at 530-345-8913. He's on the corner of 3rd Avenue and the Esplanade, not literally perhaps, but you can find his office there. Neil Yelland, Edward Jones member, SIPC. And we're supported by the generous contributions as well of Peterson Tree Care, because trees need care. John Peterson continues his family tradition of caring for Chico's amazing natural resource. Licensed, bonded, and insured, with financing available, Peterson Tree Care handles residential and commercial properties, can be reached at 518-0924. We'll remind you that up at 6 o'clock today, it's Bobby Tryon with North State Give and Take. She'll be talking with Tyler and Melissa Beery about Berry Creek United. And we also want to advise you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. Here's our interview with Rod Fujita and Naya Van Leeuwen. This is Ecotopia, exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. Our guests tonight via Zoom pre-record are Naya Van Leeuwen and Rob Fujita. They are co-authors with two others of a book that lays out and simplifies the complexities of getting people to make the changes that can help save the planet. It's called Making Shift Happen, Designing for Successful Environmental Behavioral Change. They are the co-founders of Root Solutions. It's a nonprofit group that helps organizations, companies, governmental agencies identify behavioral leverage points in their initiatives, then assist in the design and implementation of cost-effective and scalable behavioral strategies.
Naya Van Leeuwen is the executive director. She has an MA from the School of Human Evolution and Social Change at the University of Arizona. She has created educational and outreach materials for the National Science Foundation and the National Geographic Society on the fragility of Earth's coral reef systems. As a fisheries specialist at the Environmental Defense Fund, she provided sustainable fishery management expertise through workshops, trainings, and resource development.
Rod Fujita is the other co-founder of Root Solutions. In addition to his role at Root Solutions, he's Director of Research and Development at Environmental Defense Fund's Oceans Program, where he's been working with fishing communities, regulators, and business leaders around the world to improve fishery policies for more than 25 years. He's helped to establish marine protected areas totaling more than 10,000 square miles and worked with partners to reduce the impacts of trawling off California's coast with an innovative private buyout and transition to more sustainable types of fishing. Actually, we wish we could talk to you today about your fishing and fishery interests, but we've got a different topic today. Maybe we'll get you back to some point to talk about the fisheries. But welcome, Rod and Naya.
Please tell us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's good to have you. Could you tell us a little bit more about Root Solutions? What is your mission? What's your focus or your approach? And how big an organization is Root Solutions?
Sure. Let me start with the mission. Let me start with the mission. Quite simply, our mission is to protect nature and the life support systems that support people and every other species that are our companions on this planet. The approach is really grounded in this understanding that every environmental problem is caused by human action. And so the key to solving these environmental problems is really to understand human behavior and try to change it and try to get people to make the choices that align with the protection of nature.
Yeah, and we're a small organization, but we're quite powerful because our mission attracts dozens of fellows, partners, and volunteers. Right now, for example, there's 7 staff members, but we have 14 people working full-time in a volunteer capacity because of their passion for the mission.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And could you just give us a brief overview of what are some of the groups that you work with? We talk about organizations, governmental agencies, nonprofits, and so forth.
Yeah, well, we've worked with foundations, nonprofits, businesses, and government. We've worked on 3 separate marine debris campaigns with NOAA. We've worked with the Nature Conservancy. We've worked with Climate Works Foundation on the future of food. We've worked with small NGOs like Rising Sun, who does home energy audits at 5,000 houses around the Bay Area, California. We've worked with quite a few organizations. Right now, we finished up work on transportation with some local municipalities, and we're working with some foundations right now on what type of barriers they have for promoting this work in their grantees and facilitating their grantees doing this work.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's quite a lot. Pretty impressive. You begin Shift Happens by discussing failed campaigns, smoking, drugs. Are there others? And why do those campaigns not work? Because there certainly has been a lot of energy and time and money put in them.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's a lot of reasons that that initiatives and campaigns fail. Of course, you know, we believe that a lot of them fail or underperform because they're not as aware of how many problems are actually human problems and specifically problems of human behavior. So you mentioned like the drug campaigns. That's a great example where, you know, a couple decades ago, they failed to understand the power of social norms so that people who were exposed to these messages about resisting drug use actually ended up being more likely to partake in drugs because of the power of social norms and the impression that they got that drug use was far more prevalent. We also draw on the wrong emotions like fear and shame instead of optimism and empathy. Another reason that campaigns fail is that they fail to do the audience research. We often think that just because something works for us, that it would work for everyone else. We fail to tailor our approaches to different audiences. You know, we really want a silver bullet but there's no one size fits all. And then, as you're aware of, for decades and still today, we operate under the information deficit model. We think that if people just understood the problem or how bad it was, that they would act. But we shouldn't assume that just because someone isn't performing a behavior, that they aren't aware of the reasons for doing so. I mean, I personally know I should exercise more and eat more vegetables.
Me too.
Yeah, exactly. The only knowledge that really reliably leads to behavior change is how-to knowledge. But we mistakenly think that behaviors follow belief. Again, if we can get someone to believe us, that they'll do something. But in fact, we modify our beliefs to align them with how we have behaved. Mm-hmm. And we take actions on our values, not necessarily our self-interest. So the rational actor model is really a flawed assumption. And finally, another reason that I think that a lot of initiatives fail is that there's too much focus put on motivation and fuel rather than on removing barriers and friction.
Tell us a little bit about what you mean by Rob, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to try to summarize because that's a lot to take in. And just to boil it down a bit, think about ourselves in our daily lives. We all have biases. We stereotype. We make all these errors that get in the way of our life goals. And it's no different for an environmental campaign. They're run by humans, too. They're designed by humans. They're implemented by humans. And so a lot of the failed campaigns have this one thing in common. And that is they rely far too much on assumptions without testing those assumptions against data. So our book is really a roadmap for how to get out of our own heads and question our assumptions and use evidence to design campaigns that really do get at the barriers that people face when they try to do the right thing by the environment.
So there is a big psychological component to what you're doing. You have to really dive deep into human behavior in order to get to solutions.
Put us at ease.
Indeed. That's the whole reason for the existence of Root Solutions. Yeah. That's right.
What we wanted to mention, too, this is a kind of a doorstop book. It's 500-some pages in length.
You weren't going to say doorstop.
I wasn't going to say doorstop, but I said doorstop. But Naya said before we started that it's a hefty tome, I think she said. The point I want to make, it's not a page-turner because every page has charts and graphs and processes that you can go through. So you don't just read this thing cover to cover. You kind of, it was called by one reviewer a workshop in a book. And so... and that's why it's a good thing for our listeners to get their hands on. So I've been around a long time in education. I started in the late 1960s, and this was the heyday of interest in B.F. Skinner and behavioral change and behavioral objectives and teaching machines. And there was a lot of nervousness then that we were all going to be turned into robots. You have a much more expansive view of behavior. Tell us a little bit about what you mean, that it's not just sending naughty boys and girls to the office so they've stopped doing what they're doing.
Yeah, well, there's a big difference between coercion and nudging, right? So what we're talking about is gentle nudges to move people toward exercising their own free will to make the right choices based on good evidence and based on the overcoming of their own cognitive biases, which every single human on the face of the planet shares. We're hardwired around certain things that we describe in the book. So we're not advocating coercion, of course. And one way to think about this is we're surrounded. We live in a sea of behavior change signals, right? So every time you walk into a grocery store, the products are arranged in a way to try to induce you to buy certain things. We're subject to continuous advertising through all of the screens that we're looking at all day, trying to get us to buy stuff. So the point is that, behavior change is among us. And a lot of it, unfortunately, is aimed at getting us to consume more stuff than we need, that results in a lot of our planet's problems. So we're trying to harness the same forces, really, but for good, not to coerce people to do things they don't want to do.
Let's dive into the book itself. It's divided into two sections. The first section describes the change process. And obviously we can't cover all the elements, but there are five of them. Foundation, initiate, uncover, design, and methods. What are some of the elements here that you emphasize in part one of the book?
Great. Yeah, in the first chapter, as you mentioned, foundations, we're introducing the foundations for the processes that are laid out later. So, you know, we start by talking about automatic and reflexive thinking. The audience might have heard this called system one and two thinking, or fast and slow thinking. We talk about the cognitive biases that are notorious for getting in the way of environmental stewardship. For example, discounting, you know, we make choices that increase our happiness now at the expense of our well-being in the future. We discuss emotions and how they work and how they shape action. We discuss behavioral spillover. That's the conditions where performing a behavior is likely to lead to either more pro-environmental behaviors or conditions where asking our audience to perform a behavior might backfire. You know, this is summed up by the mentality that, oh, I recycle, so I can go ahead and buy everything online and have it shipped to me. Mm-hmm. We also discuss the ethics of behavior change. And finally, the importance of testing your messages and initiatives on your audience. The second chapter, it's called Initiate. And here we talk about where in the system we might want to intervene. Are we going to work with policymakers or the public? Are we going to work on individual behavior change, or are we going to work on shifting mental models? We also provide a systematic approach for choosing the behavior and the audience that we're going to work with based on fit, feasibility, impact, and more criteria. Uncover, the third chapter, is really the linchpin of making shift happen. And I know we'll talk about this a little more, but in this chapter, we introduce the 20 major drivers of human behavior. These are what lead people to either perform or not perform the behaviors that we're hoping for. And in this chapter, we provide an evidence-based framework for uncovering which of these are driving your audience right now and which of these are most likely to bring about the behavior you seek if you focus on it. Mm-hmm. In the fourth chapter, design, it lays out approaches for segmenting our audiences. You know, as I mentioned, there's no one-size-fits-all approach. Right. So you might want to segment audiences based on values, likelihood of adoption, or other meaningful demographics. This is also the chapter where we choose the appropriate shifters from the second half of the book, based on your audience's drivers, based on, you know, what you uncovered in the Uncover chapter. And we also deep dive into agile prototyping, which allows us to identify problems and make necessary adjustments before we roll out our initiative. This allows us to, you know, be quick and affordable, you know, before we put substantial resources into our projects. And then the final chapter, the methods chapter, maybe it's a misnomer because the whole book is methods.
Yes.
But the methods chapter are the methods that aren't particular to behavior change. They're about, you know, how do you do survey design? How do you run a focus group? You know, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Susan.
Well, how do you do your audience analysis? I mean, it's clear to me from what you've said so far that you have to know pretty specifically who your audience is in order to have an appropriate project or an appropriate way to work. So how do you do that? And can you have projects that are too large or projects that are too small?
Yeah, well, let me take the first part of that question.
Okay.
So there's several ways that we interface with our audience. You know, the more times you can interface with them through the entire process, or in fact include them in, you know, the entire process,
right,
the better. Right. But as I mentioned, the linchpin of our process is in the Uncover, where we do something that we call a behavioral drivers analysis. And drivers, as I mentioned, are the things that lead people to perform or not perform behaviors. And there's 20 of them. They're also called barriers and benefits, barriers and motivators, fuel and friction. And generally, these fall into three categories: means, motivation, and memory. So means, that has to do with, you know, are the policies enabling that the behavior that we're seeking? For example, renters can't upgrade their home for fuel efficiency or energy efficiency if it breaks the terms of their lease. Right. Farmers can't adopt better practices because of the terms of their bank loans. Restaurants are often prohibited from allowing customers to bring reusable containers for health code reasons. So that would be a means issue. Other means issues are, do we have access to the time and the money that we need to perform the behavior? Access can also be something like security. We were working on a project, or we were working on training specifically a group of people that work on recycling and composting for the city of St. Louis. And they were talking about how houses, two rows of houses, share a back alley. And there's these rows of back alleys, and that's where the composting and the recycling is. Well, women, when we went, when you go and you get to know the audience, a lot of women, especially in the winter when it's dark out, they don't feel that they have access to composting and recycling. They can't go into this dark alley. Another means thing might be ability. Like, do we have the how-to knowledge? Do we have the skills? And do we have the efficacy? I mentioned that there's a second group of drivers. Those are motivation ones. Do we think it's important? How important is it compared to everything else that we worry about? Do we think that the problem affects us? Do we think it's our responsibility? Do we think something bad will happen if we act on the behavior? Or do we think that something bad will happen if we don't act? And finally, you know, do we think others do it? You know, social norms. Mm-hmm. And then the third category I mentioned was memory. And so how is it that we uncover these, right? There's a very particular way that you uncover them, because people are not always aware of what their drivers are. You know, they can't pinpoint them. Right. And so there's very particular questions that we ask that get at, you know, these drivers. And as I mentioned, you know, most environmental campaigns underperform because they operate on assumptions and they don't take the time to understand this. Now, all of that being said, you know, there are these particular questions, but even if you just ask your audience a few questions about their barriers, you would be well ahead of the curve in designing your initiatives.
That also touches on your other question, Susan, about the size of the project. So I don't think there's any project too small, because humans are social beings and we like to copy each other. It's a kind of a mental shortcut that we use. So, you know, I know a lot of really great stories about tiny, tiny environmental initiatives that start in one neighborhood in New York City or one village in India, you know, that become nationwide initiatives because there's something attractive about them. Often they're not about the environment. They speak to more core values, like the need to belong to some community of people that's doing something bigger than themselves. That's a very noble feature of being human, and it's a very powerful motivator of our behavior. So if you can frame an environmental initiative in terms of community belonging, you know, doing something with purpose that gives meaning to one's life, then it can really catch fire and spread and scale. There's also such a thing as a big, unwieldy, overgeneralized project that has unclear goals and doesn't have a clear strategy and burns up money and resources and time to no end. And a lot of the book is about trying to avoid that scenario.
Yeah. Right.
And the last thing I'd like to say is that, you know, even though the book emphasizes the need to question your assumptions and use evidence to design campaigns that really address the drivers of human behavior and turn those around, it doesn't require a whole staff of PhD scientists to do. You know, at one end of the spectrum, it's really about asking people in your community, what turns you on? You know, what motivates you? What do we need to do to get you to clean up that empty lot or remove litter or increase recycling rates, right? It's not that hard. But at the other end, if you're dealing with a very complicated set of audiences, you really, you know, you do need to invest in some audience segmentation and research to understand what's driving diverse groups of people.
Right. And so,
yeah, thanks.
Go ahead.
Maya?
Oh, yeah, I wanted to add to that. Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that, Rod, because one thing that I really want people to understand is that even a simple change in program design can lead to like a really unexpected success. And one of my favorite examples is Virgin Atlantic. They, for 8 months, gave feedback to their pilots on fuel use, kind of like that energy bill that you get that shows how you're doing compared to your neighbors and might have a smiley face. Well, in 8 months, they saved over $4 million at a cost of only $3,000 to implement this program. $3,000 and one major intervention, and it led to $4 million savings and all of the accompanying greenhouse gas reduction as well. And the more you do, you know, the more little things you do, the differences keep adding up.
I wanted to say, too, in my reading, especially part one, I came away with the need to focus and not be... I think back to my own career. I was in teacher education for English teachers, and my goal was to change the way English is taught everywhere in the world. And a little more focus would have helped. But you say we do set off with kind of grandiose. I'm going to save the world today. We're going to reform environmental practices all over the world. And you're calling it, you say, zero in on the audience, scale down the project. We'll talk a little bit later about global scale. We want to ask you about how that fits in. But again, what I took away was zero in, do the research, find out what people think, find out what their drivers, their motivation is, and then zero in on that, get your campaign really focused, and keep it within the resources you have available so you don't wind up squandering it. Susan wants to talk.
No, we're processing what you're saying as you're saying it. The audience segmentation seems really significant because you do have, I'm thinking about Chico and the kinds of changes we need to make in Chico, and we have a climate action plan, but there's so many people who have very varied notions of climate change and the means to solve that problem. It's a huge problem and it's a huge audience. So those kinds of things are really helpful in thinking about how you get to that audience. Audiences.
We're going to make a bit of a transition. This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Rod Fujita and Naya Van Leeuwen about their impressive new book. It's called Making Shift Happen, Designing for Successful Environmental Behavioral Change. We got an examination copy from the publisher New Society, one of our favorite publishers. They do great books. And we're happy to loan that copy out if any listeners want to have a look at it. But you can also go on the New Society website, get yourself a copy. It's the kind of thing you'll keep around and refer to for years. So the first half of the book emphasizes focus and design pretty much and the research background. Second part describes behavioral building blocks. I can't recite all of them, but I do know they add up to the word behavioral. They are belonging, easy, habits, attachment, vivid, identity, optimism, rewards, association, and longevity. We're not going to talk about all of those in the next 20 minutes or so. But we'd like to, first, how does the second half differ from the first half in its focus? How does it help the change maker at this point?
Yeah, great. Yeah, so the second half focuses on what we call behavioral shifters. And you'll probably notice that that relates to making shift happen. You know, shifters are what we call solutions. They're also sometimes called interventions in the literature. But, you know, that sounded a little, you know, medical to us, or, you know, so we didn't want to use that word. And so the, you know, as you know, publishers often do the naming of books. It's a good thing. Right. I mean, we wanted to call our nonprofit like the Center for Behavioral, you know, Environmental Behavioral Research. And one of our board members said, you know, you should call it Root Solution, since, you know, human behavior is at the root of the problem and the root of the solution. So the publisher named the book and we loved it. So we call these solution shifters to go with, you know, with the publisher. Yeah. And, you know, all shifters are different, you know, and they each have a different design. And so, you know, the second half of the book, we divide up these, you know, hundreds and hundreds of shifters, and we take the most robust ones and we group them into these really logical categories. You know, and as you mentioned, you know, the first one is belonging, which is about social norms. And then the second one is about, you know, making things easy, and on and on.
Which ones do we want to talk about? How about, you've talked a little bit about belonging. I think that we kind of covered that in the first part of the interview. How can a campaign be easy?
Or how do you make
it? How do you make it easy?
Yeah, well, this is one of the most important solution sets in my mind. You know, we tend to focus on motivation or fuel, and that's because we want to convince people, right? We use data and evidence to demonstrate the value of our ideas, and if that doesn't work, we try to sell our vision, you know, even more strongly. We use incentives or penalties. We make stronger emotional appeals. But in the end, you know, it's better to push a rock downhill than to push it uphill. It's better to remove the barriers than it is to apply effort. And in fact, trying to sell our idea can lead to friction itself. You know, the stronger the push, too many facts, too much evidence, the stronger the push back. That's called reactance. It's our human impulse to push back against, you know, someone trying to get us to do something or take away our control. So when we focus on barriers, you know, we're the most effective when we focus on making something easy. But we don't tend to do this because, you know, it's much easier for us as humans to relate and understand what motivates us. And it's much harder to see what stops us. And understanding that requires an uncovering process, right? Understanding the context, the emotional needs of our audience. And it requires perspective taking. Mainly, it requires us focusing on our audience rather than ideas, than our idea. Mm-hmm. And that being said, though, you know, we can always make things easier for other people. We can make sure that what we're asking people to do is really easy to understand. We can do something that's called reducing hassle factors. That's simplifying choices, reducing the number of steps. One of the best ways to reduce hassle factors is to design a default. That's the easiest for our audience. They do nothing and the behavior that we want happens. And, you know, a default that everyone knows is double-sided printing, right? So you mindlessly just hit print, but you've already set up the printer to do the double-sided work for you. The other thing we can do is make sure that people have access to the resources that they need and the how-to knowledge. Essentially, you know, you probably recognize that I'm parroting back everything from the behavioral determinants analysis. You know, do people have the means to do this? Making something easy is making sure that people have, you know, those means. And finally, we can also add friction to behaviors that we don't really want people doing. We can make those behaviors harder.
We wanted to ask you a little bit about one example you give throughout the book, and maybe this is the place to do it, and that was the Berkeley Paper Saving Project, where habits, we said, are really, really hard to change, but you had good success at Berkeley getting people to, you gave us one example, the double-sided printing. Tell us a little more about what you did in Berkeley.
Yeah, well, so we really liked this project. You know, it was interesting. We wanted to work with professors at the Haas School of Business as our, you know, pilot department. But this is one of those examples where sometimes you find out that there is a much more low-hanging fruit or a more appropriate audience to work with. And it turns out that students were that audience. They were passionate about making Haas the first zero-waste building on campus. That was something kind of already like in their sphere of thinking. And so paper-saving messages were tied to those goals. You know, of course, we started by conducting research and we found out some really interesting things. And one was a norm that was really easy to correct, a mistaken norm. You know, professors thought that students wanted printed readers, you know, that it's that they want the ability to, you know, to see it on paper, write with a pen. And that's true for some students, but it turns out that the vast majority of students, you know, didn't want that. And in fact, 89% of the students supported reducing paper use. You know, we designed the program the way that you would often design a, you know, a paper saving campaign. A lot of them follow the same things, but we tailored it to our audience. This particular audience, you know, enjoys competition. So we designed a competition along with how-to knowledge. Like I said, one of the, you know, make it easy, prompts and reminders, help their memory, feedback, pledges and commitments, and you know, social norms. And the project was really successful. You know, students printed, you know, far less readers and non-mandatory lecture slides. Their knowledge of how to reduce paper increased, as well as their desire to spread that knowledge. They supported, you know, campus-wide paper-saving policies. And altogether, there was a 32% reduction in paper use. But what I found the most amazing, personally, is that students at Haas had been given a $200 per semester print budget. And as we know, you know, when you have this money, you use it. And when you get to the end of it, then you start conserving. Well, these students voluntarily wanted and agreed to lower their print budget to $150 the next semester and $100 the following semester. Great. I mean, this is incredible.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's really great. I keep thinking of a project that I'm working on right now. Everything you say, I'm trying to apply to how can I do that with my project. So this is amazing, personally amazing.
Yes. You
talk about storytelling as a key to the process, and I am big on storytelling. I want to know how you use it and what kind of impact that has.
And then we're going to have a fight over the word narrative, but you go ahead first.
We aren't.
Yeah. Well, I'll start. So, you know, the reason storytelling is really important, and I know you guys know this, but humans think in narratives, right? Like an example is I can point to a tree, but how do I point to the economy or how do I point to my own values, right? These are all done in narratives. You know, so humans were hardwired for stories. We even become immersed in stories of people that aren't real and events that never happened, right? They're easier to process than facts and statistics. We don't have to force ourselves to pay attention to them. You know, they don't take as much cognitive effort. We remember things better when they're stories. We feel closer to the content. We trust the content more. And when tested, stories consistently outperform facts and statistics for persuasiveness. I think it's really important to say that a common misconception is how important facts and figures are as opposed to an anecdote. You know, as a scientist, I relate to this. Like, I struggle to use an anecdote as proof, right? Mm-hmm. But if we want to be effective, we actually have to learn to put, you know, some of that like science desire aside and to tell stories, and better yet, you know, stories of single individuals. And finally, you know, stories are contagious, right? People want to spread them.
Right, right.
Yeah. So, I just add that you know, the stories are fundamental to environmental improvement because in one sense, everything that people do, either as individuals or communities or nations or on the global scale, is part of a story. It's the story that's running in your head as an individual is, you know, what kind of person am I? Where did I come from? why am I here? That guides all your decisions, right? The metaphors, how you construct reality. It's all part of the story that's running in your brain. Mm-hmm. And the same thing goes for communities. You know, Oakland has a story that defines it as a city. San Francisco, all cities have some kind of a story that differentiates that place from another place. And the same goes for corporations. They're all based on some kind of a story about what our purpose is, whether it's to build cars or whatever. And countries, same thing. It's based on a story that hundreds of millions of people believe about what the values are, what our founders did, where are we going as a country. So one could argue that those stories are kind of falling apart right now, but we need stories to structure our world and to give our lives purpose. And so that's the reason why storytelling is so fundamental. It's not just an effective advocacy tool, as Nye described, but it's really the key to systemic change at the global scale and at the local scale and at the national scale. If you can change the story, you can change the world. And we can talk about more about that if you'd like later.
I just have a follow-up question. What do you do when you have the stories that conflict? Like the city of Chico, there are two very distinct stories. How do you work with that?
No, one way that we found really effective is to get everybody in a room, have a really skilled facilitator who can make people feel really respected and heard, which is another fundamental human need.
Yes.
And then you can use a variety of tools to get people to express the hidden beliefs and assumptions and metaphors that are guiding their positions. So that people can hear them and then co-construct a new truth together. So, you know, one way we do that is by system mapping. So like if people really have very different views about how a fishery operates or, you know, why the wildlife are disappearing from this nature reserve or whatever the issue is, very often if you get them in the room and give space, create this cognitive space for people to get out of their cognitive biases, move away from their prejudices, move away from their assumptions, and think really hard, activate the slow thinking part of the brain, right? Mm. That's the key thing. Then people start to converge on objective facts rather than the scripts that are running in their heads. And they can sometimes, very often actually, if the facilitator is skilled, move away from positions, which is, I don't want to do anything to help Chico, or, you know, that's going to cost jobs, or, you know, why care about birds or fish? We need that water to grow crops. You know, those are all positions, but those are different from interests. So the key is like to get people to come to their common interests by moving off their position. So maybe there's some common interest in Chico to make Chico a greater community, or to create more jobs in Chico, or to have higher quality of life by having more trees and streams and, you know, whatever it is. I don't live in Chico, but that's the essence of the process, is to get people to get out of their heads and tell their stories in a respectful way, be really heard, and then co-create a new reality that's aligned with their core values and common interests.
I have to throw in my little worry here about narrative, and Susan and I fight about this regularly. I totally agree, understand your notion of emphasis on story and storytelling. I'm concerned that over the past maybe 15, 20, 30 years, the word narrative has been conflated with propaganda. And you hear this a lot in media where people say, oh, we're going to shift the narrative now. That narrative didn't work, even though the worldview may not have changed that much. So I think we have to be really cautious about, you know, I actually got first onto this listening to sports broadcasts where they say, well, here's a guy who did really bad things. Now we're going to change the narrative so the crowds will cheer him as he runs down the field instead of booing him. Could I ask your thoughts on that worry of mine?
It's very wise. I mean, there's the difference between alternative narratives and alternative facts. And right. I think as a society, we're undergoing a a pretty profound moment here where people are confusing the two. And so when we talk about narratives, you know, we want the narrative to conform to reality, right? But humans are so cognitively biased that we see the world in a very distorted way. And so the purpose of a lot of these methods that we promote in the book are really to get people to undistort their view, to take the funny glasses off so they can see clearly and listen deeply and get a really clear understanding of the way the world actually works, not the kind of super biased narratives that we're consuming, you know, in the media.
Yeah. I'm looking at our time here. Let's jump to longevity. I was fascinated by the longevity description because in the end you're talking about a walk in the woods. This is very different from what I expected when I thought you were going to write about longevity. Please tell us about that concept and what you recommend.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, so this is the final chapter of Making Shift Happen. And you know, one of the tenets of our process is that long-term motivation isn't necessarily needed for short-term behavior change, right? Many of our solutions don't require people to even care about the environment. You know, that's something I know we didn't have a lot of time to talk about, but you know, our messages, you know, don't have to be trying to convince people, you know, that we are right. They can be, you know, meeting people where they're at. Do they care about pollution and asthma? Well, let's talk about that, right? We do have several chapters where we're really thinking about the long game. And so that's our chapter on habits. It's our chapter on framing and building mental models. And then this chapter, right? This chapter is about what do we need to do as environmentalists if we want to put ourselves out of a job? You know, so the first half of the chapter is about that. Like, how do we help our audience develop intrinsic motivation? And for intrinsic motivation, we really need people's relationship with the planet to fundamentally change. You know, people need to see themselves as being in a relationship with the planet. And the most powerful intrinsic motivators are empathy and compassion. You know, so throughout the whole book, we talk about emotions. You know, we have some of the short-term emotions like fear that might spark action right away, but then lead to paralysis. You know, here we're really talking about the long-term emotions. And you know, an example that the audience might be familiar with is my favorite movie at the moment. It's called My Octopus Teacher. And it's a man, I think he was burnt out. He needed some time off from working at National Geographic, being a photographer. He wanted some time in his home country. And he met an octopus. And he started to spend time, you know, with this one creature. And not only did he spend time with him, but he decided he wanted to understand the point of view of the world from the octopus point of view. He did something that we call perspective taking. And that's one of the things that we talk about in this chapter. You know, so the movie is a powerful example for me of how we build empathy and compassion for an individual creature that can then extend out to whole populations, then to the whole ocean, and then to the whole planet. You know, so the first half of the book really is about getting into nature, developing, you know, a closer relationship, with the planet. It also, you know, talks about the power of the environment on our mind, right? So when we have to focus a lot, you know, it takes a lot of energy. And even having, you know, small amounts of time to look on nature or even photographs of nature, if you were in, you know, an urban setting or green roofs or a garden, you know, can help us mentally and emotionally.
Yeah, I mean, this chapter really tries to speak to two aspects of longevity, right? One is to try to keep activists around for a long time. It's really easy to burn out as an activist. The world is a difficult, complicated place. The challenges that we face are profound and very challenging. So we need to restore ourselves as activists. We can't keep going on the fumes of anger and fear forever. And so to sustain an activist mentality and all the difficult things that activists have to do, really we find that nature is healing. And it's really essential for activists to take the time to reconnect to the positive emotions and passions that drive their activism, rather than to face anger and frustration all the time. And, you know, we all have limited reserves of directed attention. And we need that directed attention to carry on the work of an activist. This is not easy work, right? To follow all these methods in making shift happen. It's really about self-care is one dimension of longevity.
Yeah.
To spend some time in nature to replenish those reserves and reconnect with positive emotions. The other aspect is, how do we improve as a species? And how do we reconnect to nature so that the motivations for protecting the planet are no longer external to us, but they're internal. We're intrinsically motivated. It's part of our character.
Right.
It's part of our moral code to do the right thing by the planet, because we feel more at one with the planet.
Right.
Could we transition a little bit to scale, which is related to the longevity issue? The clock is ticking for the planet. There is urgency. And your focus is on smaller projects. So how do we get all those small projects together in such a way, in such a scale, that in fact we can, save the planet? That's a small question. You've got about 2 minutes to answer.
Okay. All right. Well, my quick answer is that the key to successful scaling is really to think about the gigantic forces that shape our society and decisions at that scale, right? So what is shaping the planet right now? It's a story about markets. It's a story about human domination of the earth. And it's at a kind of a lower level. It's policies. And where do the policies come from? They come from social norms and other stories that we're telling ourselves about how we belong on this planet. The key to scaling from these small projects is to find ways to connect the little projects to these big forces that really shape everything around us. So if your project is around changing social norms in the community, and then other communities catch on, the norm itself is the scaling agent. Right. If we can change social norms, we can change the behavior of tens of millions of people. This is reflected in fashion fads and, you know, all kinds of music fads. You can see how these things go viral through the social norming process. The other big scaling factor is policy. So if you can get a lot of projects going in these various communities, and then you build up a political constituency of like-minded people who then push a bill through Congress or the European Union or the Japanese Parliament or whatever, that's another way you can get scale. And the third way is to engage in market forces in a more constructive way, to not just be victims of market forces, but to shape market forces, to be active, you know, voters and shareholders in the corporations that we're invested in to change their behavior. And that all kind of relies on changing individual views and the views of groups of people to exert their power, speak truth to power in these larger forums that are capable of scaled impact.
I just have to say, the thing that I am taking away from Making Shift Happen and from how you talk about it is that we need to be more patient. We need to take our time. We need to do all of the homework before we can expect shift to happen.
Okay, well, they're nodding on Zoom.
Thank
so
you.
We have just now, we really do have a couple of minutes left. So how can our listeners learn more about Root Solutions and then actively, sort of learn about other groups that are allied with this kind of cause? But tell us a little more about how they can learn about Root Solutions.
Well, I mean, they can go to our website to learn more about us.
Yeah.
You know, definitely, you know, to learn about us, you know, also buy the book. I mean, this book, you know, we love it because it pretty much guarantees that for the cost of a book, you know, your projects, you know, are going to improve. You know, we also offer training based on the book. We have a training series coming up in May. People can take the entire 10-week series, which takes the place of a normal 3-day in-person training, or they can just take a single module if they want to learn more about some of the concepts we discussed, like how to uncover barriers or social norms or framing. We can also help with initiatives, and an approach we particularly like is a coaching model where the organization conducts the project on their own, but we train them intermittently and coach them along the way. You know, so all of this can be found out on our website, and there are a lot of really great groups like us. You know, when we started, we were one of the first, you know, first people in the neighborhood. But I'm really gratified to see that there's a lot of groups that are, you know, stepping into this space, you know, because ultimately, if we can understand that, you know, that human behavior is, you know, something we need to understand as well as we understand environmental science, I think our progress can only accelerate.
Yeah, that's great. This has been a wonderful interview. The book is wonderful. We recommend that people get it and act on it, be patient, and do all of the parts that have to be done. But we thank you very much, Naya Van Leeuwen and Rod Fujita, for being with us on Ecotopia and for the great work you do. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you and how supportive you are of our work.
Really good. Thanks a lot for having us on. Good to talk to you.
You are the new.
You are.